welcome to another edition of the On Fryer podcast. Baseball is back. Forget about all this other nonsense. Todd Strain is here because Darnay Tripp is having his first anniversary. He is out hiking some big national park somewhere. Todd, thanks for joining us.
While Darnay celebrates 1 year of marriage, we celebrate the return of the San Diego Padres in America's pastime. I'm excited, and I can tell, and I know you are excited.
Yes, I think this is the thing that is more worth celebrating. As much as I love my wife, and we're going to have our first anniversary next month, yeah, she understands baseball is my first love. First, let's get this out of the way, because we have a really cool guest here today. We got Ryan Spader, the ace of Spader, has been a guest on this podcast before. Statistical genius. He's like the Rain Man of baseball stats. So let's talk about first, though, about the OGs. Big sponsor of the On Fryer podcast. They have been open this entire time. Take out, go out and get yourself some of the new specials. Can't wait to be able to get back in there and be able to watch a game. All the TVs always on the sports. Good sticks, good beers, good pizzas. Todd, I know you've been there a few times. Again, huge thanks to OGs for everything that they do for the podcast and for the NBC7 Sports Desk. They're sponsoring up as well.
I like everything about OGs. The pizza is delicious. The beer is good. And bring the kids. They can play some video games, too. Fun all around.
We don't have video games in our homes anymore. You're absolutely correct. All right. Forget about that. Obviously, you could tell I just want to start talking about baseball. I'll start talking baseball stats. Ryan Spader is back. The ace of Spader on Twitter and Facebook and the Instagram. Ryan, thanks for joining us again, man. How are you doing out there on the East Coast?
I'm doing great, and I'm really happy to be back and with the new co-host you got here.
Yeah, Todd's good peeps. All right, let's just jump in right here right now, because we got a 60 game schedule. And the first guy I thought about talking to was Ryan, because the first thing I started thinking about was, okay, baseball loves its stats, right? There's no other game that's tied to its statistical history like baseball is. So you're carving 102 games off the season. And as we say, anybody can get hot for a 60 game stretch. So Ryan, let's kind of go a little overarching thing right now. What do you see as, let's say, like home run title, wins, saves, what some of the bigger, more marquee stats that we get, or maybe even war? Who's going to be on top in a shorter season like this? Who do you see being able to get hot for that 60 game stretch? And is the obvious answer always just Mike Trout?
Well, Mike Trout's going to be Mike Trout, and he's going to do what he always does. But I think we're going to be surprised here, because as you're saying, over a 60-game stretch, just about anything could happen. If we had a 60-game stretch last year, I think Bellinger would have ended up close to 400. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see a 400 hitter. I wouldn't be surprised if we see somebody who finishes the season with, let's call it 25 home runs, which would be on pace to break the major league record or close to it. And then we're going to be left forever asking these questions, just as we ask about 1994. You know, what if Gwynn finished 1994? Well, we're confident he would have batted 400. He could have finished batting 400 had he not had a slow start that year. And I mean slow in terms of Tony Gwynn.
Only about 315, yeah.
right. But I think we're going to be it's going to be interesting, and it's going to be a season that's talked to probably for the rest of our lives, because you're going to get some of these really, really strange numbers, even stranger than we got in 1994. Everybody loves to go back and be like, Matt Williams was going to break the home run record. I don't think he was going to. I think he was just hot for a good portion of that season. It got his average over for two-thirds of the season to be on that 61 home run pace. But if you pull 60 game spans, and I have a few of them if you want me to pull them up that
I've done. That's why we have you here. Bring it.
But if you look at some of the 60 game spans throughout history, you've seen some people do remarkable things. Now, what I did for the most part was look at the first 60 games, because that's what we're looking at here. I also want, I'll say betters to consider the fact that we're starting this season in what Charlie Manuel calls hitting season, because it's going to be hot, nice weather. I saw the over-under for home runs set at 20. Now, 20 over 60 games is a pace for 54 home runs. I would be very confident that it will be over 20. If you go throughout the last 10 seasons, 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 19, there was at least one guy to hit 20 home runs during the first 60 games. And they started the season at regular time in the cold weather for a lot of them. And
they're trying to pace themselves. You know, they're thinking, right. I've got a 162 game season. You don't want to come out swinging. You're right. You got the cold weather in the Northeast. You got the cold weather in the Northwest. Now it's summer everywhere. I mean, the ball is going to be flying like they usually don't do early in the season.
Yeah. So I'm not one to give betting advice, but I'm really confident in that over on the 20. I might lay a little bit down there. And then the one season I left out was 2018. We had three guys hit 19 home runs to start that season. So I can't believe that that's where Vegas set that number. It just doesn't seem right to me.
Hey, Ryan, you brought up something interesting to me, at least. You said, how will people react and view whatever statistics happen from this season? Say there's some sort of huge surge and somebody hits 25, 30 homers or something like that, or somebody bats 425. You mentioned how we look back at previous seasons that have been impacted or shorter by strikes or whatnot. Is there any way that if somebody hits 425, that will be valued historically as someone hitting 400 in a full baseball season, or will that just be discounted?
So I'm actually really glad you asked that, because it won't be valued. In fact, if a player hits 390, in my opinion, that would be held in greater value than if somebody does hit over 400. Because if somebody hits over 400, you're going to have all the people screaming, well, that doesn't count. If somebody hits 390, then you're going to have the people asking, well, what would he have done over the full season? I mean, his last 30 games, he was batting 440. And then also with the home runs, if somebody hits 25, 30 home runs, then you're going to have a situation where people are like, well, if he extrapolated over 162 games, then he potentially could have gotten that record. And I just disagree with that, because I think players play generally, when you look over the course of a season, stretches of 20 to 25 games where they're hot or not, or in between. And you're going to have a guy who strings together one, two, maybe even three of those, and just put up tremendous numbers when extrapolated over a 162 game season. And people like to do those extrapolations. We know it well, because they did it in 1994, even 1995, when they missed 18 games. And when you're going to look at this season, I'm telling you, it's going to be, if somebody does something like bat 400, you know, that's Ted Williams' thing. That will be written off by most. It will go down as a 400 average, but with an asterisk or something like that. But if somebody hits 395, then everybody will be asking, what if instead? So I almost hope somebody doesn't bat a 400, because, I mean, it would be cool to see, but I just don't want to deal with people not relishing in that accomplishment, because it's still an accomplishment, but you got to take it for face value. And the fact of the matter is that if you're batting 425 after 60 games, that's probably the hottest you're going to be over the course. That's likely to decrease to the norm. It's just the way numbers work, and it's the way baseball works. 162 games is a grueling schedule.
So how much of that has to do with who does it? Because let's use like the home run total as an example. Like if someone hits 27 home runs for the season, and that person is, say, you know, Ronald Acuna or a Fernando Tatis, these young guys who you think they have that kind of power, but do they look at that and go, okay, well, he just caught lightning in a bottle for a while. He's not a 65 home run guy. But if Aaron Judge does it, and everyone knows Aaron Judge is already a 50-55 home run guy, then we look at it and go, oh, he's the guy who would have, you know, gotten up to 70 and he would have done it naturally. Does the person who gets the number, does that play into the inevitable debate that comes after all of this?
Yes, absolutely. And with the home runs, I think the only two who would actually get a pass and people would be like, he would have done it, are Aaron Judge and Mike Trout. I think then otherwise you're going to have both the naysayers and the people looking at it, the season, like, I must have said this word eight or nine times already. If you extrapolated over 162 games, then, you know, he would have finished with 75 home runs. But then you're also going to have the people who are realists. And I'll be honest. When it comes to the 1994 season, I'm one who asks what if, and I like to see that. And of course, they played nearly twice as many games as they're going to play this year. But the fact is, you just generally can't do over 162 games, which are going to do over your best 60 game stretch. I mean, a guy even like Barry Bonds, when he hit 73 home runs, I think it was between April 12th and then the next 60 games that he played from there. He hit 37 home runs over 60 games and had a slugging percentage over 1,000. That's just ridiculous. But if you put that over the span,
he was cheating, but yeah, it is still great numbers.
Oh, come on.
Derek, come on.
But if you put the 37 home runs over a full season, well, you're looking at somebody who would have hit over 90 homers.
I think what you guys bring up is very interesting from an individual standpoint. You're basically going on how accomplished the player is, then we'll leave his season. If he's not as accomplished, then it'll kind of be looked at as a fluke. And I think most people would say the same thing for which team will win the World Series. If the Yankees or Dodgers or Astros win the World Series, it'll be like, yeah, they would have won anyways. If some outlier team or something like Reds, White Sox, or Padres win the World Series, I think people will look at it like that was a fluke. I think that the same kind of thing will be in play for team success as well this season.
So as far as the World Series goes, and I'm really hoping we get to that point, because a lot of people are talking about right now, like, oh, the second wave this and that, and we're not going to finish the season, we're not going to start the season. I'm inclined to think it's going to go start to finish in it through the postseason. But that World Series champion, in my eyes, should be held in the highest regard, because you're not playing baseball this year. It's a completely different sport. There's so many different rule changes. Don't even get me started with the guy on second, with man on second in extra innings for no reason. I actually had somebody say to me, well, they're playing 60 games over the course of 66 days. And I said to him, they do that when they play 162 games. That's a 91% of days you're playing a game. In a regular normal season over 162 games, it's at about 89, sometimes around 90%. It's almost the exact same thing, and it's still a shorter span. So you're dealing with less wear and tear. You're going to see, I think, a lot more players, if they're able to stay healthy, play north of 90% of the games. And we don't really see that too often over 162 games season any longer.
So we're focused on offense right now. How about the pitching staff is going to be what are really intriguing to me, because I think bullpens, if everybody's kind of going the way they thought they're going to be going, and Jace Tingler talked to the media in San Diego during the week saying it's good to have a nice deep bullpen because of how he's going to have to use some of these arms, especially with guys like Denelson Lamet and Garrett Richards coming off of Tommy John surgery. Maybe a guy like a Luis Patino or a Mackenzie Gore being involved, and they've never pitched above Double-A before. You're not sure what you're getting from them. Ryan, what do you think the pitching staffs are going to look like? Is it going to be the three guys? You know, will Josh Hader throw every other day no matter what happens? Because he threw 75 innings last year anyway. Will he throw 40 innings, you know, for the Brewers out of the 60 games that they play this year? How will the bullpens be used? And then statistically, how will we value or disvalue the performance of starting pitchers and relief pitchers in this kind of an environment?
So a lot of people, what I have heard, are thinking, well, starting pitchers, they're only going to have to start a dozen games, so they're going to throw more innings. I actually think they'll throw fewer innings, and I think you're going to see some teams going with a four-man rotation where they're throwing only five innings with their starter and then yank them. Three innings with their starter or opener and then yank them, and then you're going to see the bullpen come out, and they're going to use their most dominant pitchers. My take is, if I am the Dodgers, for example, I'm throwing Clayton Kershaw every third day. Three innings. Give me three innings to start a game, and then you're out. And you're looking at 60 innings over the course of 66 days, and I think that that's something that Clayton Kershaw can absolutely handle. And then I think people would reject that concept because they say, well – he's used to pitching every fifth day. Well, while that is true, they also have a throwing day on the side in between there, and they're not facing, you know, live action or anything, but it's still, you're still throwing it like you're supposed to go into that, like you're pitching it in a game. And I just am really interested to see what teams will go with something like a three-man rotation and throw these guys four innings and then go with their bullpen. And I think it's going to happen.
I'm interested to see how what does that apply? Does it apply like Max Scherzer's of the world? Does that apply to the Steven Strasburg? I can't imagine Dave Martinez walking out after four innings and trying to get the ball for Max Scherzer when he's given up one hit and has five strikeouts. Like that conversation will not go well.
I don't think with the Nationals that's going to go well, period, because their bullpen's not that great to begin with. But I think I would see, I could see the Nationals going with maybe the four-man, five-man rotation. Could you imagine if they went with the three, though, and had Scherzer, Strasburg, and Corbin throwing every third day, only throwing three, four innings?
Yeah, good luck.
That unique strategy you guys bring up is really interesting, because I think one of the key things in this season are things are going to be different, whether it's pitchers throwing three innings, multiple starts in a week, how you use the DH in the National League. You're getting, one of the keys to success, I think, is getting a buy-in from your team to embrace some of these things that traditionally aren't baseball, or how these players have grown up 25, 30 years playing traditional baseball. It's going to be different. You're going to need your team to buy in. I mean, they're going to be sitting in the stands and then pinch hitting in the seventh inning. Things are going to be different, and how teams buy into this and really embrace the change could be key to different team success for sure. Scherzer giving up the ball.
I think the best way to get the teams to buy in is, first of all, these guys have to trust their leadership, their coaches. But then also early team success. You know, if the Padres are in first place after 17 games, they're like, we've played over a third of the season. We can do this. And especially if they're taking the approach of some strange tactic to playing it, they're like, all right, this works, let's do it. It maybe wouldn't work over 162 games, but it's worked. It could work for over 60. And I really believe you're going to see some strange manipulation of these rotations, because again, this is not baseball that we're playing. It's baseball in the field, yeah, but it's not baseball as we know it. It's not 162 games this year, and it's really a shame that it isn't. Another thing that not to veer off to the side on you guys, but another thing that I'm really interested to see is who's going to be the Harold Baines out of this, right? Baines missed out on strikes in 91 or 81, 94, 95. And because of that, he missed out of 3,000 hits. He fell short of, I want to say it was 400 doubles and then 300 home runs. And then he got into the Hall of Fame. The reason he got into the Hall of Fame was because Tony La Russa said, look, it's not his fault there wasn't baseball. If he had 3,000 hits, he would have probably been on the first, second, third ballot. And people bought into that, and the Veterans Committee voted him in. Who's going to fall short of milestones because of this?
And another guy, in San Diego, we know Fred McGriff. Fred McGriff lost time in 94-95. He finished with 493 home runs. The same number of home runs as some guy named Lou freaking Gehrig. And Fred McGriff is not in the Hall of Fame. If Fred McGriff has 500 home runs on his resume, which if he plays another 50 games in 94 or 95, he's hitting seven more home runs. I don't think anybody is going to, you know, argue against that at all. So who is this? The first guy that comes to mind for me is a guy like Miguel Cabrera, who, again, he has a couple of years left on his contract, but he's, I think, 180, 85 or so hits away from 3,000. He's 20-something, 25 or so home runs away from 500. He's 37 years old. Obviously, time is catching up to him, as it does for everybody. Is he a guy who, losing 100 games this year, maybe that keeps him from, you know, knocking down those mythical numbers of 3,000 and 500 and the like?
I think it could potentially cost him 500. I think he gets to 3,000, but his power is not quite what it once was. And it's just really a shame. You think of some other guys like Albert Pujols, who's in the tail end of his career. What is he going to be like when he comes back? And then when we look at his overall career numbers and the fact that he missed 100 games, which it, you know, it may not seem like that much to some people, but over the course of 2,000 games, that's 5% of your career. Over the course of 1,000 games, that's 10% of your career. And where his final home run and hit total land, and then who's kind of within reach of that, we're going to be like, ah, it's a shame that we missed out on that season, because Pujols would have beaten, you know, this guy and moved up in the 3,000 hit club and moved up in a 500, 600, 700 home run club. And it's, as a numbers guy, it's like almost offensive to me.
Yeah, especially when you're talking about guys like that. I mean, Miguel Cabrera and Albert Pujols, they're getting in the Hall of Fame. So there's not, I don't think they're going to have a, you know, a Baines or a Pujols type situation. But those, like I said at the beginning of this podcast, numbers mean something in baseball. And if you get to that 700 home run level, that's different. There are three men who hit 700 home runs in the history of baseball. It's Barry Bonds, it's Hank Aaron, and it's Babe freaking Ruth. So if you could have a chance, if you lose a chance to get to that stratosphere, that's going to mean something to maybe not a legacy, but certainly to him and his career.
And you guys, something else to keep in mind with compiling numbers, it's not just the guys at the end of their career who may fall a few short. Guys at the beginning of their career, like Fernando Tatis Jr., who missed a significant change or chunk of the season last year with injury, if he misses this year, I mean, that's a huge amount of games that he's missing the chance early in his season to compile RBIs, home runs. That diminishes from his total. Mike Trout, all these guys, they're missing huge time to put up these numbers too. So when they get to the end of their year, their season, they may be 100, you know, 60 to 100 homers less than what they would have and miss milestones as well. So it's not just the guys at the end. I mean, the damage is being done to guys throughout the spectrum.
Just a caveat off that, you're also going to have these guys, like, let's say Fernando Tatis Jr. comes out and he struggles through 20, 30 games. Typically, you're like, ah, it's, you know, I can get out of this. I got 142, 132 left to play. And now you're going to be looking at a third of the season, a half the season's gone, and that could lead to continued struggles. It kind of, a lot of these guys, as you well know, baseball players, to be a baseball player and play at this elite level, you have to have a little bit of an ego. You have to have a little bit of arrogance. And if you're looking at your season and you're halfway done and you're hitting 202, you're kind of probably going to feel lost.
And Manny Machado was a guy who last year got off to a bad start. And then he had that 160-game stretch from about, you know, late May to July or so, where he looked like Manny Machado again. And then the wheels fell off for the Padres. If Manny Machado has another slow 30-game start, that's half the season. And then do you start getting in the argument with Jace Tingler post-game press conferences via Zoom, by the way, which I'll have to do everything, saying, how long can you ride with Manny Machado because you got a couple guys behind him who are hitting the ball pretty well? Like, those are conversations that are going to come up. It's going to be incredibly strange because you're right, in a 162-game season, you go, Manny will figure it out. But can you wait him for him to do it for a half a season like happened last year?
Well, I don't think you ever take Manny Machado out of that lineup.
Or any other lineup, yeah. But those, here's the thing, those questions would come, and that's how strange this is.
One thought on that is something I've heard brought up is, say Manny Machado gets off to a slow start. For example, let's use Manny as an example. Struggling, Padres fall behind, they lose, you know, 10 of their first 14 games. They're pretty much out of it. You get 30, 35 games in. Are you sitting these players down? Because what's the point, you know, health risk? Also, if you take your stars out, then you get a chance to look at some of your younger players. And then how fair is the season even moving forward? I mean, you brought it up, Derek. I mean, you can argue with Jace Tingler who's hidden behind Manny Machado. But if Manny Machado and stars start being pulled from lineups 35, 40 games in, that's a huge problem for baseball, I think.
Well, I think, Ryan, I'll ask you that. Yeah, that goes to roster construction. You're going to have interesting roster construction. Ryan, how do you think this is going to you know, play out, especially with what's going on? Because you're right, there is risk of health issues.
Well, I think this is why I thought it was so important to expand the playoffs, which I want to do anyway. I think it should be 8 on either side. You kind of have a NCAA March Madness type bracket. Last year, for example, the Yankees would have been the one seed, the two seed, and then the Red Sox would have been the seven. And then my contention is that they should play a three-game series, all at Yankee Stadium, huge advantage for them, and play the postseason that way. And a lot of people said, well, you know, it already goes to November. Well, the way that I set it up, the postseason would have only added an additional 3 days. Now, we're going with the same postseason schedule this year. I think it was very important to add additional teams because then other teams would still be in it and they'd have incentive to keep their players on the field. Now, they're going to have disincentive to continue playing their top guys.
So who picks up? Because we have no minor league system. I mean, there's not going to be minor league baseball. You're going to have that 40-man roster and then the 20-man taxi squad. So technically, you've got 60 people that you can pull from. That's still nothing like you have when you have, you know, an entire, you know, affiliate chain. When you can go down to AAA and get one of their 24 guys. You can go down at AAA. You can go to AA and get a couple of those guys. You can find another, you know, 75 you can pull from versus 60. So what do you do now when you've got that contingency? Somebody gets hurt. Maybe somebody has to go into quarantine for 10, 14 days, however long it's going to take each individual to go through that. What do you do? How do you look at what you've got in your system and you know you can't just put them on the farm and let them keep developing? You still got to get these guys at bats. You got to get them on the mound. You got to get them to do the Taylor Trammell with the Padres needs to get at bats. He's not gonna be able to get that at El Paso this year. Does he then stay up with the big club simply because they need the top prospects to be able to play somewhere at a high level?
I think so, absolutely. And I think for the most part, and this is a vast generalization, but for the most part, we're going to see the same guys getting called up, so to say, that we would have otherwise seen in a 162-game season. However, I also see the value in the Orioles, who we know I looked at their best 60-game stretch last year, and they were 24-36. We know that they're not going to be one of the teams at the end. But I see value in having Adley Rutschman, right? I've always
number one pick,
name.
Yeah, like the catcher.
I see value in having him on that squad. Give him big league time, and then at the end of the day, if he doesn't perform, there's always that concern that people have that, you know, if a rookie gets called up too soon, doesn't perform, he never does what he was supposed to do. Well, I think you could probably convince the kid that, hey, man, this was not a regular season. You did not get called up from the minors. You didn't have your fresh at bats. We're going to start with a fresh, clean slate next year. We're going to have you in Double A. We're going to call you up midway through to Triple A and then expect that call back to be our starting catcher in September.
What's going to be interesting about this season, too, is you look at guys in spring training of 2019. And the two that come to mind from us, of course, are Fernando Tatis Jr. Didn't know that he was going to be on the roster or not. And then on opening day, you say, how in the world do we ever think this guy was not going to be on the roster? Pete Alonso was going through the same thing for a long time with the Mets. So who's going to be that guy? Do we have time in this big old break we've had between spring training and now the 3 weeks you're going to have to get ready to find those kinds of guys who are maybe fringe roster rookie kind of guys who in a normal way would be able to work their way up and then have a massive rookie season?
I don't know who the guy's going to be, but I'm certain there will be one. I would be willing to bet that a rookie who you wouldn't otherwise think will end up in the top 10 in MVP votes this year. A rookie will end up in the top 10 in Cy Young Award votes. I mean, how many times do we see a rookie get called up and he's just lights out for his first 10, 12 starts? I always default to Zach Duke, who got called up with the Pirates. I think he had 12 games and an ERA under 2 or something, just absolutely lights out. And then he was mediocre the rest of his career. And he had a nice career, better than the one I had, but, you know, he was mediocre after that. And I'm telling you, I wouldn't at all be surprised to see a rookie take away one of the awards that one of our all-star veterans would otherwise win over 162 games.
Mark the Bird Fidrich lives in a 60-game season.
6 shutouts, right?
That would be so much fun to watch. So, Ryan, I'm excited about this because it is going to be that sprint. I mean, it is going to be that that this is the playoffs every single day. Yeah. How excited should we be about how teams are going to approach this year? Because you know, throw stats out the window, guys are going to still try and get theirs, but there are going to be some wacky stuff going on, as you said, especially with pitching staffs. How excited should we be to see just how completely random and interesting that this season is? And then how much does that stick if it works over a 60-game season? Do they try that over a 162-game season as we move forward?
I'm very excited for baseball, but just for the fact that it's baseball. If they try to implement some of this stuff over 162 games, I'd lose my damn mind. I cannot stand the fact that we're going to put a guy on second base for no reason. It's not baseball. It's not the way the game is played. I don't like the universal DH, but we all knew that was coming anyway in 2022. For that very reason is why they put it in 2021 as well. But this guy on second thing, I really hope they don't try to make that proposition in after the 2021 season for the collective bargaining agreement, because it's nonsense. And it frustrates me a great deal that Rob Manfred thinks that by pitchers not throwing the intentional walk, by making it an automatic walk, that we are going to bring new fans to the game. Because Rob, you just saved 1.54 pitches per game. That is a fact. That is the number. 1.54, not per team, but per game. You've saved us 40 seconds. I don't think any kid is going to want to watch the game now because they're not throwing those intentional walk pitch. I don't think any kid isn't going to want to watch the game now for a chance at it going into extra innings and then you get a ghost runner on second. I really hope none of this stuff sticks. But let's be excited for the fact that we have a 60-game season. We have, like you said, playoff baseball essentially all season long. It's going to be really exciting, but it's what's going to upset me is if they start considering, well, maybe we should cut the season because this was more exciting. We had more viewerships. I don't think that would ever happen because I think that's money out of ownership's pockets, right, with fewer games and fewer games for fans to attend. I just am excited for baseball, and I'm trying to not put myself in a position where I'm so excited for the fact that there's baseball that I'm ignoring all the things I dislike about what they're doing this season.
You're hoping some of this stuff doesn't move forward. Like, can we call them ghost runners? Can we call it the ghost runner rule?
Because I think we should call it ghost runners. Cool. I like that.
Because that's what you do when you're playing wiffle ball. All right, ghost runner on third. I got to go hit again. We don't have enough guys.
What if they use a ghost runner and you play like wiffle ball style? The relay throw just had to cross the plate before the ghost runner gets there.
Oh, let's just have throwies while we're at it. If you hit the runner while he's not on base with the ball, he's out. What other schoolyard crap are we gonna do here?
Oh, goodness! I love it.
Four outfielders. We're slow pitch softball.
Hey, let me.
Some teams do that anyway with defensive alignment.
Let me guys ask you a statistical question before we go, real quick. What's a realistic target for most wins in those 60 games? What are we looking at? Something around 40 or a little more?
Well, for a team?
Yeah.
I would say, I think 40 would be exceptional, but I wouldn't at all be surprised to see it at 37. I also wouldn't be at all surprised to see it at 45. The Astros' best – so the Astros, their team, they're making this postseason. Their worst 60-game stretch last year was 35 and 25. But their best was 47 and 13. Mm. So I wouldn't at all be surprised to see it land anywhere between 37, 47. Could you imagine a team winning 50 out of 60? And then we're looking at this like, oh, we missed out on and again, we're getting nostalgic with the 1994 season. Well, we missed out on Tony Gwynn hitting 400. We missed out on a team winning 115 games when in reality, that's just not the way things work over 162 games.
Okay, Ryan, most wacky possible stat we're going to see this year. We talked about the rookies possibly jumping in and winning, MVPs or Cy Youngs. What's the crazy stuff you think might happen? And I want to make sure we get to some of those 60-game comps that you said you had as well.
So I think nothing's going to be crazier than somebody hitting 400. However, because baseball is the way that it is, could you imagine if somebody went and broke the 56 game hit streak over a 60 game season, or one that would bother me to no end, a pitcher with a perfect game in a 0-0 game that goes into extra innings, and then you got a guy on second base in a perfect game, and it's over, I guess.
Does that end the perfect game?
I don't know. I think there needs to be a I think they should put the stipulation that you only get the runner in second if the opposing team has removed their starting pitcher, which would fix that. But I hate that rule so much with a burning
passion. Should I ask you about how the ghost runner impacts ERAs? They've already kind of said it doesn't, but it just adds a whole nother layer that just so confusing and so wrong.
So it doesn't count as an earned run, but a pitcher can lose a game that way. And another thing that bothers me a great deal is when you score first, you are more likely to win a game. You got the other team playing from behind. So if you're the away team in an extra inning game, you, in theory, have eliminated home field advantage if they're able to score that runner on second. And expected runs for a man on second with nobody out is 1.07 runs, meaning they're probably going to score a run at some point. That's just the way that this goes. However, I also pulled all these numbers on how many games we're actually going to prevent from going the distance. And I just did that by looking at the full season last year. I don't have it right in front of me, but I believe it was 2,479 games, of which 208 went into extra innings. 117 of those went beyond the 10th inning. So by those same numbers, we're going to see a max 25 games prevented from going beyond 10 innings, because – and some of those were – excuse me, 40 games go beyond 10 innings, but 15 of them, they're – both teams are going to score, and then they're going to continue playing anyway. And about 20 – so we save maybe 25 games from going a little bit further. And then we're robbed of that one 19-inning game we get a year, the 14-inning or the 13-inning marathon, or position players pitching and all that stuff that makes baseball fun. That's why I'll forgive Manfred if he's not intending to implement this in the future after the CBA, because all I was concerned about was there has to be baseball this year. I thought this they were going to go as crazy as – 7-inning doubleheaders every day to try to get in games. And they didn't go that crazy, but I would have even forgiven that just to get baseball on the field. I won't forgive that stuff going forward when we're back to real baseball. And I also won't forgive Manfred, just for the record, for paying off people during the Mitchell Report thing and not properly releasing information, and then also being involved in the blackballing opinion of Mark McGwire and Barry Bonds.
I think also we're going to back to this, and Manfred, man, we've said it here before, Manfred is the Frito Corleone of sports commissioners. He messes everything up. He doesn't really have any kind of a purpose. He's just kind of there doing whatever anybody else tells him to do. He didn't have any gumption. And I'm not a Manfred fan either, and I usually like to keep it as toward the middle as I can with players and owners. What the owners and what Major League Baseball did during all this was just so heinous and disgusting that it's going to be hard for me to look at the commissioner or the commissioner's office the same way again. And this whole thing about putting a runner on second base, the problem I have with it is, what do we all value so much for offensive players in baseball? It's the ability to get on base. So you're diminishing that by just throwing someone on second base. Do you know how hard it is to get on second base, to hit a double, or to, you know, to get a ground ball that maybe is a tough play and there's an error and you're about second? It's very difficult to get on second base with nobody out in Major League Baseball. And it's almost like they're just saying, okay, just go do that. Now, I understand it's to try and keep pitchers from throwing too much during this time. Okay, that's fantastic. But I agree with you 100%, Ryan. If this tries to go beyond this year, that it's just we're just trying everything just to make sure people stay healthy, that's not okay with me.
Yeah, again, it's just not baseball. And I've said it throughout this whole conversation. Like this year, this is not baseball as we know it. It's good enough for the situation that we're in. And I just really hope that going forward, we can get back to baseball as we know it.
With the way they're going to use pitching staffs, will we see a relief pitcher lead the league in wins?
That is very interesting. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
Yeah, that just popped into my head.
Because starting pitchers are going to get what, 10 to 12 starts? So you're looking at maybe 6 or 7 wins.
Well, that's if they use conventional starting pitching, and I don't think they will.
That's correct.
Especially if you have teams that go with a 4-man rotation, and they're just throwing these guys 3-4 innings, they don't even qualify for the win.
Yeah.
Right. Will Drew Pomeranz be the guy who leads the league in wins? Because as you know, you come in, we've all watched it. Somebody comes in with 4 2/3, right? It's a 2-2 game. They throw one pitch, they get a pop out, and then the team comes in and scores 3 runs, and they win the game, 5-4. The guy who threw one pitch and is pulled for a pinch hitter, he gets the win. Which is why we all hate the wins rule in Major League Baseball. But this year we can actually have some fun of making fun of the wins rule, because I could totally see a relief pitcher leading the league in wins.
I might need to go to Vegas and put some money on a relief pitcher from the Yankees or Dodgers for the Cy Young. How about
I think 60 games is probably a little too long for a relief pitcher to end up leading the league in wins. But with the crazy things that I'm anticipating happening in these rotations, I wouldn't be surprised.
Who has the best chance, roster construction right now? Who has the best chance? Like, we know how good the Dodgers are. We know how good the Yankees are. We know how good the Astros are. We know who the alphas of Major League Baseball are. Who's the next tier? Who has the best chance to sneak in and win 40 games and maybe knock somebody off their perch?
So maybe I'm being a homer here with the Phillies, but that, they're a team that
fell apart. I knew you were
going
to say
that. Last year. They're a team that fell apart last year. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see them have some success. I do think we're going to see something silly like the Pirates just on fire in the first 60 games like they would have otherwise been. Something just absurd that we wouldn't have otherwise seen. Another team, the Rockies. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens with the Rockies, because they generally have a pretty good start to each season. But I do anticipate a really strange team squeaking into the postseason. And who knows? We've seen stranger things. The Marlins winning the World Series, 97-03, and they were just a wild card team. I think the one year they maybe only won 84 games, and then it went on to win it all.
That's one of the great stats of all time. The Marlins have never won a division championship, but they've won 2 World Series titles.
That's awesome.
How that happens, I have absolutely no idea. But as you get in the tournament, and then you can make some hay. I mean, you've looked at the Padres roster. So you got guys like Chris Paddock. You guys like, Fernando Tatis Jr. You got guys like Manny Machado. Can the Padres be one of those clubs that catches that lightning in the bottle? 45-45 at the All-Star break last year, and then the wheels went flying completely
absolutely
off. Can they be one of those teams? It's like 34 wins and they get in as a wild card.
Absolutely, they could be. Not at all would I be surprised, especially if we see teams starting to trend in the direction of, well, we're out of it after 35, 40 games, so we are not going to go with our team as we know it and rest our star players. Let's send them home potentially even. And I wouldn't be surprised to see, like I said, Pirates, Padres, Rockies. These are the teams that are typically pretty good halfway through the season and then fall off. The Phillies did it as well, as I said. And I wouldn't at all be surprised to see one of those teams squeak in. And then who knows, once it's postseason, you're playing different baseball.
Is there a carryover effect there? Yeah, is there, if you have success this year and you get that postseason success, is there a carryover? Does that then translate to next year when hopefully we do have a 162 game season?
I don't think so. I look to the Red Sox when they won it in they win 14 and then they had one of the worst records
13.
In the game.
Yeah, 2013.
One of the worst records in the league in 15. I just don't think these things carry year to year, but in a way that they do carry is if the Padres say they were to go on and win the World Series, well, then they're selling out opener next year and people are going to be excited about Padres baseball again. So that changes the atmosphere of a game. And maybe in that way, it does help to the team succeed in the future.
Hey, Ryan and Derek, speaking of the Padres, something that keeps coming up is how, and we referenced it earlier, but we didn't really address it. How would you two guys handle their young guys, like Mackenzie Gore, Trammell, those kind of things? How would you handle them this season? Would you give Gore a few major league innings, or is that off the table?
Ryan, I'll give it to you.
Them. Yeah. I'm playing them because to me, I look at it like you cannot have your organization's top 1, 2, 3 prospect not play baseball this year. You absolutely stifle their growth. And in a 162 game season, you might make the argument that calling them up too soon could hamper their growth, but nothing's going to prevent them from blossoming any more than a year off from baseball. You cannot have a young, supposed to be future all-star, not playing this game.
Yeah, what's good for the Padres right now, too, is three of their top guys in Patino and Gore and Trammell, they're on that doorstep where they were in Major League spring training. They were fighting for spots on the job. It's not like a C.J. Abrams, who's only played, you know, short season A-ball because he was a first-round pick just a year ago. You're not talking about guys. This is an organization that has a lot of their top guys who are close enough to pull that off. A guy like Abrams, who's only played in the Arizona Rookie League and then the Northwest League and then, you know, like 8 at-bats at Fort Wayne, and you don't want to bring that guy up because he's nowhere near ready. But this is an organization that has enough guys near major league ready that you can do that with and bring them up. Now, one thing a lot of people do even now, and I don't know why they do this because people cannot turn the page, they don't think the Padres hold on to any of their stars. Trade them at the deadline. There's going to be a trade deadline this year. And I think this is absolutely fascinating because it's going to be at the end of August. It's basically 24 or so games left in the season. Less than half the year in a 60-game season, you're going to have trades going on. Ryan, what do you anticipate that looking like? Because that's going to be – if there are enough teams right around, you know, within 5, 6 games of a wild card spot, which you figure there would be because teams haven't separated themselves yet over that long of a season, what's that going to look like? Because that could be the Wild West.
I think it's going to be absolute madness because one thing that you didn't mention there, and that's – I don't know if I've seen anybody consider it, is the owners are going to be in their GM's ear being like, hey, we're not making any money. You've got to get rid of this guy and his contract. And I think there's going to be a lot of trades come August 31st for that reason, from some of those smaller market teams dumping some of their biggest contracts because they didn't make any money with no fans in the stands and, you know, 37 and change percent of a season, that they're going to be more inclined to tell their GMs, the owners, to tell their GMs that I need you to get rid of this salary.
So that means the Yankees and the Dodgers and the Reds. Then we go back to the teams with all the money. And this is one of the biggest problems in baseball in the first place.
You're exactly right, Derek, because if one owner is looking to shred salary, you have to have an owner, and it's going to be those teams, those big money teams, would be willing to take on more salary. That could be few and far between in these lean years, so it's going to be most likely those big market money clubs.
Ryan, is there any way that the teams we talked about here, the Yankees with the depth of their roster, the Dodgers with the depth of their roster, the Astros with the depth of their roster, is there, barring mass injuries or 15 guys testing positive and missing 2 weeks, is there any scenario where those teams don't make the playoffs?
So I was trying to find one, actually, because what I was doing was looking at the best and worst 60-game stretches. And those teams, when you talk about the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Astros, even the Twins last year, when you look at even their worst 60-game stretch, they were still postseason teams. So I just don't see it happening. But I don't want to say let's hope, but I wouldn't be surprised if another team catches that same lightning in a bottle, so to say, and maybe they don't play their best 60 games. Maybe they play their worst 60 games, and another team plays their best, and then you end up with one of them out of it.
That'd be fascinating. That would truly be fascinating. Not seeing one of those clubs that we know are incredible baseball teams, not seeing one of them, just seeing them just kind of scuffling along. And then that takes you to what we just talked about with the trade deadline. Then those teams are going to be even more motivated to go to those other smaller market clubs. Like, you don't want to pay that dude's salary, give them to us. You know, it's, it's going to be fascinating to see that. Speaking of the Dodgers, Mookie Betts, he's going to be a free agent next year. In a 60-game season, and now he's got his whole, you know, career. But going to a National League is very different. Learning a brand-new set of pitchers is going to be very different. For guys like that, can this hurt their ability to earn money on the free agent market next year? If, let's say, he's not the same guy he was because he has to learn all these new pitchers and new ballparks, and it's just completely different for him.
I kind of think with the implementation of interleague baseball and the fact that now it's played for over 10% of a team's season, that these guys, for the most part, know each other and know their tendencies. It's not like it once was when baseball was – I'm a very anti-interleague baseball. It's not fair to a team like the Padres when they get stuck playing the Astros and the Rangers and then maybe, let's say, the Yankees or something, and then another team – who's going for that same wild card ends up playing cellar dwellers. It's just not fair. It's just not fair to those teams. I don't think that this is going to be a problem for him. He's an elite player. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he's the one to hit 400. I'll let you guys pull that clip if he is in the future and cut it and make me look good. But I think he's going to be a stud. I think he's going to go into the free agency, and he's going to get his $300 million contract. If anything's going to hurt his earning ability, it's going to be maybe owners are less likely to fork over that money because this season cost them so much, and it is costing them money. But I think one of those top teams is just going to be like, yo, we're going after Mookie. Don't care what it costs.
And that gives you those five clubs that we always talk about every time. Man, all right. Did we miss anything? Is there any other statistical anomaly or fun stat that we can look at this year for a 60-game Major League Baseball season?
I don't have a stat, but I have something that is very interesting to me. There were so many players within the game that were upset with the Houston Astros. You could almost see this season playing out for the Astros as kind of like one game every series early in the season where they're going to be beaned and there's going to be brawls and there's going to be blowbacks.
No. Fighting is expressly prohibited.
That's what I'm saying. So I think the Astros get a win on this because no one's going to be beaning batters because you're going to get suspended and they'll ruin your season.
Everyone will be beating batters because you can't fight. There's no
repercussion. So the Astros get a free pass. Get a free pass.
Ryan, what say you? I say that you hit everybody if you're playing the Astros because you can't fight anybody. Now, granted, you're going to get all your guys domed too, but I think that's a trade a lot of teams will make.
I've got to be honest. I don't think the intention, maybe there would have been a handful of them, but I really don't think that was going to happen very often. There was a line out on the number of hit batsmen that the Astros would have had, and if they got the over, it would have been historical. I was going to put everything I have on the under. And I just don't see that happening. I think the Astros get a free pass in the fact that they're not going to be dealing with fans in opposing team stadiums. In fact, the Astros are one team that may actually put fans in their stadium because they're in Texas. So they're not going to deal with that. But when we talk about the Astros, we got to go back to the whole thing. The fact of the matter is, I have a good authority that there were 8 to 9 other teams who did similar nefarious acts. I also firmly believe that if you think the most efficient way to deliver a signal to a batter is by banging on a trash can, then I've got, what do they say? I got a waterfront property to sell you in Kansas or something. I just don't buy that. What I think is the Astros thought they were circumventing the rules by not using electronics. And so what they did was took a little bit of new school with the television screens, which is allowed, took the old school, banging on a trash can, something we would expect in the 1900s, that when they were stealing signs, they stole signs in the 1900s and delivered them through the scoreboard. And they stole signs in the 1940s and 50s and delivered them by means other than a guy on second base. I think the Astros went into that like, we found a way that it's not technically cheating. And so they did that. I think there were more nefarious means used to deliver signs to batters. And I think that it happened between 8 and 9 other teams. Now you go back to why weren't any of the players who did this suspended? Well, when you suspend a player for this, you're taking away his meal ticket. And as soon as you're taking away money from out of a guy's pocket, he's going to sing like a canary. And then I think other players, Astros, would have started naming names in terms of other players. They just were in the position where they didn't want to be fires, who's despised by not just Astros, but a lot of players throughout the league, because he named names, and that's something you don't do.
That's like the mafia. You don't name, you don't snitch, man. You just don't do it. And I agree that if anybody thinks that this is an isolated thing by the Astros or the Red Sox or whoever, everybody in baseball is looking for an edge at some point. And everyone's going to try and find it wherever they can. You're right. The whole banging on a trash can thing, I think, was one of two things. Either A, as you said, I didn't even consider that just being an older school way of doing it. I thought it was probably a distraction from where the actual thing was coming from, because that's just weird, banging on a trash can. It's going to bring all the attention in the world to you.
I don't think they would have 2 points of failure, so to say. Because if they're doing something else and had the trash cans, you have dual points of failure. I don't think you set yourself up like that. I just really think they thought they found a way of circumventing the no technology rule, because it's not technology. It's banging on a damn trash can.
Todd, you had to go and get us talking about the Astros, didn't you? You had to go and get us talking about the Astros.
Sorry.
Ryan, this has been awesome, man. Thank you for all the insight and all the time. Always love talking to you. By the way, everybody follow him at the Ace of Spader on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. By the way, how you doing out there?
I'm doing great. I got out of the military, and I was fortunate enough to walk right into a job where I'm teleworking, which has been fantastic. I count myself among the very fortunate, because I'm not struggling through this financially like some are. And I'm just happy that I'm able to continue working in baseball. In fact, this job is even better for me in working for baseball, because I can work from 6 a.m. till 2, and then I'm clear. I only sleep 4 hours a night, so that's not a problem. You know, I sleep from 2 a.m. to 6 a.m. most nights. And
who are you, John Gruden?
I don't think so. I just trained myself to do it over the course of many years. Maybe it'll eventually catch up to me. My first book I wrote while I was in school for the Marine Corps to learn my MOS. I would pull an all-nighter on Monday night, Wednesday night, and Friday night, and I would sleep regular hours Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and then I would do nothing but working on the book on the weekends and manage to get it out on time.
That's awesome. You got another book coming out anytime soon?
I'm working on one. I don't have a release date. What I'm working on is every ball player in history who was also in the service, because it's kind of my two things combined into one. Kevin and I released the second version of Incredible Baseball Stats last time around, but I'm more into talking baseball. I don't really care about plugs. I got one more for you though, because I know I said I had some first 60 games for you, and there's one I have to throw at you, because it's one of my favorite ball players of all time. I think he's one of the most underrated players ever. Only 4 Hall of Fame votes, and I just look at his career. And I look at the numbers, the advanced statistics, the old school statistics, and I see a Hall of Famer, but nobody else really does, because he was a first baseman who didn't have all that pop that you typically see from first baseman. I think that when you're a first baseman, you're judged so much harder than other positions on your offensive performance. When you're a second baseman, you're judged more harshly than a shortstop, as with third baseman. If you look throughout history, third baseman have inducted into the BBW or into the Hall of Fame by BBWAA. They're the elite among the elite. You got Pie Trainer, Eddie Matthews,
Chipper Jones, Mike Schmidt, Matthews.
Chipper Jones. There's six third basemen, and they inducted a slew of shortstops. But just to get to this number, I want to give you one guy who was hitting over 400 through 60 games, and that's my guy, John Olerud, batting 401. With a 500 on base percentage and a 708 slugging through 60 games in 1993.
With the Blue Jays when they won the World Series.
Let's not talk about that in the field. 1993 World Series. All right.
I forgot the Philly thing. Sorry. John Olerud had one of the sweetest swings I think I may have
ever seen. He's a hell of a pitcher, too.
Yeah, Washington State, he was a really good pitcher.
12-1.
You know, let me ask you this about, there's another guy, and he actually told me this stat when I was working in Arizona. It's Mark Grace. If you look at the guy who led the any decade in hits, that person is either in the Hall of Fame or going to be in the Hall of Fame. Except Mark Grace led the 90s in base hits, and he was wiped out of Hall of Fame contention almost immediately. Like Ichiro in for the aughts, he's going to get in. Before that, it was guys like Tony Gwynn. It was, people who are just some of the greatest hitters of all time. Why did Mark Grace not get any kind of Hall of Fame run? San Diego State
first baseman.
Guy.
First baseman. The only reason. Power. If he was a second baseman, he would be in the Hall of Fame right now. The fact of the matter is, Hall of Fame voters, and this drives me nuts, they take into consideration, and sorry if either one of you are, I shouldn't, this is a generalization.
We're not important enough.
Most take into consideration defense only when it's exemplary defense, right? The greatest defense. But they ignore it if it's awful. If it's awful defense, it gets written off. And then they didn't want to let in a guy like Edgar Martinez because he didn't play he didn't play a position. Well, Major League Baseball decided that the DH was going to be a part of baseball. And if it's a part of baseball, it should be a part of the Hall of Fame. And so to say this guy only played half the game, I've seen ballots where you didn't vote for Edgar Martinez, but you voted for, no offense, Trevor Hoffman. Well, Trevor Hoffman is this specialist among specialists among specialists. He's throwing one inning a game in save situations. What about the guy who's playing 160 games, coming to bat four or five times a game? That is a specialist. It's just a hitting specialist versus a pitching specialist. And I've torn into that the argument of he didn't play in the field so many times. Ted Williams was not a good left fielder. Derek Jeter was not a good defensive shortstop. There are so many guys who are in the Hall of Fame who were poor defensive players. The fact of the matter is Edgar Martinez was a damn good third baseman, but his bat was so good that they were worried about that he would continue getting hurt. So they said, all right, we're just going to have you hit. And that's how good he was. But to get back to Mark Grace, the only reason he is not in the Hall of Fame is because he played first base. He could have played because he was a good first baseman. Maybe he could have played a decent second base. Maybe he would have sucked at it. Either way, it wouldn't have mattered, and he would be in the Hall of Fame today.
I always make the argument, whenever someone said he only played half the game, the DH thing, I say, then why did you vote for pitchers who spent their entire career in the American League, especially before interleague play? They never hit.
Point.
They didn't. They only played half the game, but nobody wants to hear that part of it.
Yeah, I think that they're just viewed in a different scope, and they shouldn't be. I also don't like the separation of offense is hands down the most important game when it comes to position, or part of the game when it comes to position players. It's in my measurement about 4.5 to 5 times more valuable than even really good defensive players. And I think when it comes down to it, Mark Grace, you look at that guy, you have to just consider his offense, even though he was a good first baseman, and realize that if you put him at any other position, he's probably in the Hall of Fame. Another thing that really drives me nuts about the Hall of Fame is a guy like Omar Vizquel. Now, I don't care if Omar Vizquel gets in the Hall of Fame. I wouldn't vote for him personally, but because he was a terrible offensive player, 18% below league average for his career. Only two seasons in which he was even average in his career. But then a guy like Jimmy Rollins, who is a far superior overall shortstop, he was a very good defensive shortstop. Omar Vizquel was an all-time great defensive shortstop. But the fact of the matter is that an all-time great shortstop is only going to make a couple more plays that a really good shortstop would otherwise make. And Rollins was head and shoulders above the offensive player that Vizquel was. Now, I'm not saying I would vote for Rollins either. He's just the example I use because he's a guy from my hometown team. I wouldn't vote for either of them. But if Vizquel gets consideration, then Rollins should get consideration. Vizquel gets this consideration. He's the all-time leader in fielding percentage at shortstop. Now, I know we don't really use that statistic anymore. Let's look at defensive runs saved quickly. And a guy like Placido Polanco, I think he was a better player than Omar Vizquel. And he is actually the all-time leading leader in fielding percentage at both second and third base. But he wasn't a shortstop, so he doesn't get the credit that Vizquel gets. And I mentioned the advanced statistics, the defensive runs saved. Well, Polanco has more than Vizquel did.
See, I can just listen to you talk stats just all like all freaking day.
Derek, you just fell into a stats trance there.
I was just like, I had no idea. Placido Polanco, when you have second and third, that
Ryan just took control of your mind there, dude.
I was like, I love this stuff. Keep speaking. Keep speaking. Actually, no, we're gonna tell you not to keep speaking because I got to get this stuff done for the 6 o'clock show, and I got to start editing all of this. But Ryan and Todd, yes, thank you so much. I always love talking ball. I always love talking ball with people who know ball. Ryan, Todd, you know ball. Thanks for this. Thanks for lecture, I guess, the seminar on all of this. This is awesome stuff, man.
Well, thanks for bringing up the Astros.
It was great to meet you, Todd.
Yes.
And Derek, I really appreciate you having me back on. I hope you'll do it again. I don't know if it's allowed, but maybe one of these times we'll do it with a beer.
Oh yeah, we can just do it virtually. We always pop one over. Actually, I'm probably more of a Scotch guy, though. If that's all right.
That's fine.
All right.
The OG's beer.
Yes, we got it. Ryan, whenever, I don't know if you ever make it out to San Diego way, but whenever you get out here, man, you know, let me know, and the first one's on me.
I appreciate it. You guys both have a great night.
All right, you too. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for listening to the On Fire podcast. Back next week.